WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Valley delegates host a town hall to raise concerns about the upcoming special election over redistricting, which Virginia's Supreme Court has ruled can go ahead. A Stanton man who fled political persecution in Cuba has been detained by ICE for more than 7 months. And we explore the challenges that honeybees and native bees face. This is the WMRA Daily for Thursday, March 5th. Local Republican delegates hosted a joint town hall on Monday to raise concerns about the upcoming special election over redistricting. WMRA's Omega Ilovich reports.
On April 21st, Virginia voters will decide whether the Democrat-led General Assembly should temporarily redraw congressional voting maps. The proposed constitutional amendment is designed to boost the National Party's chances in November midterm elections and oppose right-wing redistricting efforts in Texas, Ohio, and other states. In a virtual town hall on Monday, delegates Tony Wilt, Chris Runyon, and Justin Pence urged constituents to vote no on the change. The three Shenandoah Valley Republicans argued the referendum was rushed to the ballot box, breaking state procedural rules along the way. Delegate Pence cited recent legal challenges to the proposal.
It seems like when you have to change so many laws to be allowed to do something, it maybe is a good sign that you shouldn't be doing it.
Delegate Runyon also argued that the amendment could quiet the political voices of rural Virginians.
And so what we're being asked to do by this small group of liberal Northern Virginia Democrats is to abandon one of our most sacred and democratic principles that voters get to choose their politicians and that elections mean something.
However, Democrats claim the proposed amendment is not a long-term redistricting solution for Virginia, but a short-term response to President Trump's national push for Republican gerrymandering. The language on the ballot says the Commonwealth would revert to standard redistricting process following the 2030 census. When asked to address this timeline, Delegate Wilt responded with suspicion.
Technically, that's the way it's written, but forgive me if I'm doubtful that that's the way that it would end up. You know, if it were to succeed, what prevents it from happening again?
Early voting for the amendment begins Friday. For WMRA News, I'm Omega Ilovich.
You can find links to more information at WMRA.org and on our app. Charlottesville City and Charlottesville City Schools are both asking for more money for their fiscal year 2027 budgets. The city proposed a roughly $280 million budget on Monday. That's more than 5% higher than last year's budget. City Manager Sam Sanders proposed a 2-cent real estate tax increase to $1 for every $100 of assessed real estate value to cover higher expenses.
The length of our financial runway is what it is, but we have a jumbo jet, so we've got to figure out how do we make this work.
Charlottesville City Schools' proposed budget totals nearly $130 million. That's a little more than 3% higher than last year's budget. City Council will now hold a series of community forums to finalize the budget. Budget adoption is scheduled for April 9th. In Harrisonburg, the proposed school budget for the next fiscal year we'll get a boost from the state. The Harrisonburg Citizen reports that will help provide staff raises, more special education faculty, and more financial support for career and technical training. A Stanton man who fled political persecution in Cuba has been detained by U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement for more than 7 months, despite entering the country legally and having a pending asylum case and green card application. WMRA's Randy B. Hagee reports.
Jose Miguel Suri Hernandez is a 26-year-old man from Cuba who entered the U.S. in November 2024. He scheduled his entrance at the border in Calexico, California, using the CBP-1 mobile application that the federal government has since discontinued. Officials released or paroled Hernandez into the country for a period of 2 years, with upcoming immigration court hearings and pathways available for both asylum and lawful permanent residence, also known as a green card. He settled in Stanton and got a job at a produce packaging facility in the county.
He's a very humble person. He's very sweet. Very kind.
Luz Hernandez, who happens to have the same last name, is Jose's girlfriend. She's a U.S. citizen who also lives in Stanton. We spoke about Jose's case in both English and Spanish with the help of translator Marissa Cortez.
He wanted to study English to be able to work and contribute to this country.
WMRA confirmed the history and status of Jose's immigration case through his attorney, Mackin Mashour, and by reviewing Department of Homeland Security and court records. Luce and Mashour say Jose left Cuba in fear of retaliation for his political activism. The Trump administration acknowledges that, quote, the communist regime persecutes and tortures its political opponents, and, quote, denies the Cuban people free speech and press, end quote. The international nonprofit watchdog Human Rights Watch has documented systematic human rights violations in response to anti-government protests there.
Porque si él regresa a Cuba.
Because if he returns to Cuba, he is going to be arrested there, and jail there is forever. Due to him protesting the Cuban government, they have even threatened his mother with taking her job.
Last March, DHS announced it was ending the program which allowed authorized Cuban, Haitian, Nicaraguan, and Venezuelan nationals to be paroled into the U.S. for up to 2 years, effective immediately. Work permits granted under this program were also terminated. Jose had been temporarily admitted to the U.S. until November of this year, but with the termination of that parole program, his cutoff date was changed to April of last year. Luce accompanied Jose to a hearing in the Sterling Immigration Court in July, where a judge dismissed Jose's initial case.
As soon as we opened the courthouse doors, ICE arrested him. They called him by his name. They said, "Are you Suri?" They arrested him right in front of me. It was a very sad thing. They were very cruel. They arrested him so roughly that they even cut through his skin. He was bleeding and everything.
ICE detained Jose despite the fact that he appears to have no criminal record, they don't allege any criminal activity, and they don't have an order for his deportation. He's been held at the Farmville Detention Center since July. The couple hired Mashour to represent Jose, and he filed applications for asylum and lawful permanent residence.
I've seen him now on 6 occasions. He's depressed. He's always been skinny, but he's even skinnier now.
The Cuban Adjustment Act of 1966 allows Cuban natives who have lived in the U.S. for a year and meet certain requirements to apply for a green card. But the Trump administration has paused green card and citizenship processing for immigrants from 19 countries on a travel ban list, including Cuba. The U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services Agency requires green card applicants to get their fingerprints taken at an agency office, so the government can verify a person's identity and run background checks. But Luce and Mashour say ICE is refusing to take Jose to get this done.
He would be free by now if they would authorize him to only get his fingerprints taken.
That's despite an immigration judge's order that WMRA reviewed, which instructs ICE to complete biometrics for him on or before January 29th. That was more than 4 weeks ago. In response to an interview request, USCIS noted that it does not comment on individual cases. Spokesman Matthew J. Tragesser did send a statement which reads, quote, a pending green card application does not shield an alien from enforcement actions by ICE. USCIS has paused all adjudications for aliens from presidentially designated high-risk countries, while we work to ensure that all aliens from these countries are vetted and screened to the maximum degree possible. The safety of the American people always comes first, end quote. While Jose's green card application is in limbo, his asylum application is still moving through the courts, with a hearing scheduled for March 13th. And Luce points out there's a third option as well, that the couple plan to pursue before his detention and have asked ICE officials to proceed with since.
We're going to get married, but he didn't bring his birth certificate from Cuba. And when his father sent it, it arrived 1 day before he was arrested here.
James Covington, a regional communications director for ICE, did not answer a list of questions before this story aired, including whether there is a policy preventing the couple from getting married while Jose is detained. Despite the obstacles they face, Luce remains
very hopeful that he'll get out and be able to continue on with his life.
Luce and friends are currently fundraising online to help pay Jose's legal fees. For WMRA News, I'm Randy B. Hagee.
We've posted a link to that fundraiser and more information at WMRA.org and on our app. Meanwhile, Virginia Republicans are highlighting the murder of a Fairfax County woman in an effort to knock Governor Abigail Spanberger's opposition to cooperation with ICE. Virginia Public Radio's Brad Kuttner reports.
Stephanie Minter, who you see behind us here today, she should be alive.
That's Colonial Heights Republican Senator Glenn Sturdivant standing in front of a photo of Stephanie Minter at a news conference Wednesday morning, decrying Governor Abigail Spanberger's efforts to pull law enforcement agencies out of federal immigration enforcement agreements.
Now, this is Governor Spanberger's first month in office, and her response has been to weaken cooperation and add barriers to federal law enforcement in Virginia.
By his logic, the undocumented man who allegedly murdered Minter should have been removed by ICE agents under what's known as a 287G agreement. But according to ICE data, only 27 agencies across Virginia's more than 130 localities are in 287G agreements. Among those not in such agreements is Sturtevant's home locality of Colonial Heights. Culpeper County Republican Senator Bryce Reeves said 287G agreements don't matter as much as the support an executive like Spanberger could be offering law enforcement.
I don't have any 287Gs, but I know the numbers that we're exporting out of my district. I just had those conversations over the weekend with my sheriffs. They don't necessarily need the federal money to enforce the immigration policy. They work with their ICE agents. They don't want to be amplified or under a microscope. They just want to get rid of those criminals. And that's what they're doing. So whether you have a 287G agreement or not really doesn't matter.
Legislation that bans localities from entering into 287G agreements is currently working through both of Virginia's legislative chambers. It got zero support from Republicans so far.
The Supreme Court of Virginia said that Virginians can begin voting this week to decide if congressional lines should be redrawn. Brad has this update.
In the order issued late Wednesday, justices of the Supreme Court of Virginia said they offered no, quote, opinion on the ultimate resolution of the Republican-led effort to stop Virginia's redistricting effort, but voting should commence Friday. Issuing an injunction to keep Virginians from the polls is not the proper way to make this decision, the ruling reads. Tazewell County, which was barred from early voting until Wednesday's order, should be all systems go. However, reporting by Cardinal News suggests that the locality has not prepared ballots and machines because of the lower court ruling. How that will impact the rural western Virginia county on Friday remains unclear. In a statement, Attorney General Jay Jones praised the ruling, saying, quote, "The court's order is clear. The referendum election will proceed." Filings in the lawsuit to stop the referendum are due just before voting ends in April, a move some say will allow the state's highest court to not get involved. If it passes, the new maps stand. If the vote fails, so does the redistricting scheme. But a recent ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court suspending the use of new pro-Democrat maps in New York State is giving hope to Colonial Heights Republican Senator Glenn Sturtevant.
When one branch of government is abusing the process and breaking the law, we have the judicial branch to step in and address that. And so far, the Virginia Supreme Court has not done that.
The hope is, once Virginia's highest court issues a final ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court could step in. But in the meantime, big turnout for Democrats in primaries across the country Tuesday are reassuring Democrats like Fairfax Delegate Dan Helmer.
And I expect that on April 21st, Virginians are going to show up in droves and help us level the playing field.
Early voting in the redistricting fight starts Friday across the Commonwealth. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Democratic leaders in the state Senate began the General Assembly session hoping to provide universal free breakfasts for public school students. But that funding is not in the proposed budget. Virginia Public Radio's Michael Pope reports.
$37 million a year. That's the cost of providing universal free school breakfast for public school students across Virginia. It was a top priority for Senate Democrats, but the effort failed, and there's no funding in either the House budget or the Senate budget. Here's Senator Danica Rome, a Democrat from Manassas.
If it's one-time funding, those tend to be simpler conversations, not necessarily easier, but simpler conversations. The ask that we have is, you know, by having a bill for this, not just a budget amendment, is to do this every year as a matter of the policy of the Commonwealth, every school year, universal free school breakfast.
The Senate budget includes $500 million for tax rebates, but no money for universal free breakfasts. Here's Emily Moore with the American Heart Association.
We continue to hear year after year that we are in agreement on the policy, but the funding costs too much and that it's too expensive. This year, we even received unanimous support in the Senate, bipartisan support in the Senate on the policy, but the hurdle continues to be that the legislature feels that the price tag is too high to feed kids.
One item that is in the Senate version of the budget, new money to help school divisions replace outdated equipment and support hiring new cafeteria workers. The House version of the budget does not have that new money, and the two chambers are expected to work out their differences next week. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
Virginia passed a law to limit kids' use of social media last year, but a federal judge blocked it before it could go into effect. Attorney General Jay Jones has promised to fight that ruling. Brad Kuttner has the details.
Last week, a federal judge found a law aiming to limit the time kids spend on social media violated their First Amendment rights, as well as the rights of adults and big tech companies. Attorney General Jay Jones says he'll fight those claims.
We know that unfettered access to addictive feeds and passive screen time is shown to hurt our kids in the long run, causing increased feelings of anxiety, depression, and isolation.
Those concerns are shared by Henrico Democratic Senator Schuyler Van Valkenburg, who authored the bill last year.
These questions are knotty. Nobody should deny that. They're difficult. Freedom of speech is very important. And we also have a compelling state interest around making sure that social media is safe for kids.
But NetChoice, the group behind the legal challenge, argues the law is an overreach, depriving not just adults of speech rights, but children as well. Here's attorney Paul Taske.
These kinds of heavy-handed, one-size-fits-none mandates for age verification and parental consent are going to fail every time.
Still, Southside Republican Senator Bill Stanley, who authored the state's age verification law for online porn, is optimistic the law will stand.
Sometimes courts are wrong, not when I'm before them and they rule in my favor, but usually the courts are wrong when they do stuff like this. And
arguments in the dispute should give insight into AG Jones' defense of the law in the coming weeks. In Richmond, I'm Brad Kuttner.
Two bills requiring Virginia theaters to show movies with subtitles will head to Governor Spanberger's desk. The Senate and House of Delegates passed the bills Tuesday. They require theaters to provide captioned movies at least 7 showings a week and during popular attendance times. The Americans with Disabilities Act already requires theaters to offer closed captioning devices, but advocates say they don't often work. The General Assembly has also passed a bill that would require schools, if they teach students about the violent attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021, to relay the facts of what actually happened. The Virginia Mercury reports the bill bans the teaching of misinformation that the 2020 presidential election was stolen or that the attack was just a peaceful protest. Special interests that want to allow online gambling may be one step closer to striking it rich. Michael Pope has the details.
Online gambling has become one of the hottest issues of this year's General Assembly session. And unlike most stuff that happens around here, it does not fall along party lines. Senate Majority Leader Scott Surovell, a Democrat, says regulating online gaming is the best way to deal with the illegal market that's already flourishing.
The best way for us to deal with it is to license it, regulate it, and tax it. That way we have control over it, instead of having the Wild West of the internet deciding what to do.
That's not an argument that's persuading 3 Democrats and 14 Republicans in the Senate. Here's Republican Senator Bill Stanley of Franklin County.
Researchers say that these products are 10 times more addictive than the slot machine at a physical casino. The claim that legalization curbs the illegal marketplace is just not correct. Pennsylvania's illegal gambling participation grew from 6 to 10% in 1 year after legalization of iGaming. Legalization feeds the black market by normalizing the behavior.
Members of the General Assembly are holding their bets for now. The version that passed the Senate this week has a reenactment clause. Even if the governor signs the bill, online casinos will have to start over with new legislation next year. Reporting from the Capitol in Richmond, I'm Michael Pope.
William & Mary is one of 13 colleges that the Pentagon is cutting ties with over accusations of so-called woke policies. WHRO's Nick McNamara reports.
The Pentagon said in its announcement that the institutions, quote, diminish critical thinking, have significant adversary involvement, or fail to deliver rigorous education grounded in realism. Federal officials say that's why they're ending the senior service program at William & Mary and other schools. William & Mary admins say they're puzzled and saddened by that, and that they got no official notice why the college was included. Only one student in the program is enrolled in Williamsburg. The Pentagon says the decision applies to all military personnel starting in 2026-27, though those currently enrolled may complete their courses. The military is eyeing Virginia Tech, George Mason, Regent University, and the University of North Carolina, among several others, as potential new partners instead.
Nick McNamara reporting. Finally today, when we think of livestock, we might think of cattle and sheep. But what about honeybees? In Virginia, both honeybees and native bee species face some common and some distinct challenges. WMRA's Aisha Pirga reports.
There are around 4,000 native bee species in the U.S., in addition to honeybee populations that people manage as livestock. Native bees are at risk globally, partially due to the threat from pesticides. But despite some public perceptions, honeybee populations have actually hit record numbers. However, beekeepers are still facing population losses, as well as the ongoing threat of disease.
I believe everybody's got their own set of difficulties with honeybees. We all fight the fact of the varroa mites in the honeybees.
Gerald Pike is the owner and operator of Pike's Apiary in Winchester. He says mites have been around for years and are widespread across the whole industry.
They die from the viruses that the mites actually carry. And those viruses are transmitted to the bees, which weakens their immune system, ultimately leading to the bees' deaths. If a bee flies out to go to get pollen from a plant and there's another bee that has a mite on it on that plant, you can get a mite on your bees from that.
Barry Gibson, who owns Hannah Bee's Apiary in Harrisonburg, also points to mites as an issue. He's also concerned about the use of pesticides by farmers.
But I've talked to a few of them around here, and pretty much they understand and will let us know if they're going to use anything. So I haven't had any pesticide drops or harm.
But concern about the mites is ubiquitous among beekeepers. Ty Ralston is the curator of the State Arboretum of Virginia and research associate professor in the Environmental Sciences Department at the University of Virginia. He says varroa mites are a unique problem for honeybees.
But there are other diseases that they can share with other species. And where looked at it, it appears that the diseases are usually going from honeybees to the other species.
Because honeybees aren't native to America, efforts to keep them healthy can mean fewer resources for native bees. Many of them, including bumblebees, are in steep decline across the country. And Ralston says native species face threats similar to those confronted by cultivated honeybees, pesticides, diseases, and land management changes. His current research focuses on propagating several mason bee species. Mason bees, which are native to North America, get their name from their use of clay to cover their nests. During my visit to Blandy Experimental Farm in Boyce, Virginia, not far from Winchester, Ralston showed me blocks of wood, which he referred to as bee hotels.
So those hotels get several species of mason bees, including both non-native ones that are increasing and very common, and native ones which are declining. But we get several species in the bee hotels.
Ralston says these bees are active in the spring.
I will move some of them into the screenhouse where I have lots of flowers for them, and then let them reproduce in the screenhouse. And then the next year, I can put them out somewhere else. So it's the same species, but the screenhouse is a way for me to make more of them.
Even though it might have led to fewer resources for native bee populations, Ralston believes initiatives to save honeybees still brought people's attention to problems that pollinators face.
So it raised a lot of awareness of the importance of pollinators, and it made a lot of awareness of threats of pesticide to pollinators, because honeybees and native bees share the same threats from pesticides. And it also had the benefit of a lot of new plantings of flowers and supports of native wildflower meadows.
Ralston said that honeybees are used commonly in large-scale agriculture, especially in apple orchards, where people often bring them in for apple pollination. But there are native pollinators in the landscape as well, such as squash bees.
He said it's an example in which native species are doing most of the pollination of a crop.
And nobody is managing for that crop pollinator. It just exists in the landscape.
He said that squash bees are the main pollinators of squash in Virginia, West Virginia, and Maryland. And he said sometimes people will put honeybees into squash or pumpkin fields, but that honeybees don't like the flowers.
Whereas squash bees are specialists of them, and they will always go to the squash because that's the only thing they collect pollen from.
All of which is a reminder that, in the bee world as elsewhere, it takes a village. In this case, a village of pollinator species that deserve our care. And while these critters are doing their jobs, it's important for us to take care of the landscape in return. For WMIA News, I'm Aisha Pia.
We've posted some photos and links to more information and a longer version of this story at WMRA.org and on our app. for WMRA News. I'm Bob Levicky. Thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy your Thursday.